Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Katie Lumsden about her historical novel, The Secrets of Hartwood Hall. Katie is a fiction editor who has an English Literature and History degree from the University of Durham and an MA in Creative Writing from Bath Spa University. Her short stories have been shortlisted for the London Short Story Prize and the Bridport Prize, as well as being published in various literary magazines. She also has a successful booktube channel, Books and Things, covering all things gothic fiction. This episode is a really fascinating one. Katie had an agent for 7 years. She wrote several different books in various genres that unfortunately failed to get a book deal. And she's also been a fiction editor for a Big Five publisher, so she's really seen things from the other side too. In this episode, we discuss all of that, as well as what it's like to play with gothic tropes, purposefully writing for the market, and whether a following on social media makes a difference in terms of book sales. But first, here's Katie with an excerpt from The Secrets of Hartwood Hall.
And now I was sitting in this carriage, heading towards my new life. It felt as though I had never been anything but a governess, as though it had been only a few weeks since I left my last place. 3 years of my life vanished into thin air. 3 years of my life and nothing but widow's weeds to show for it. I thought of Richard, his dark eyes, his freckled face, his gaunt figure those last few weeks. I shut my eyes tight. Beyond the carriage windows, the weather was turning. The sky had darkened from blue to mottled grey. I reached into my skirt pocket for my watch, well, Richard's watch, though it was mine now, and saw that it was not yet 7 o'clock. I heard a rumble of thunder, and the coachman outside uttered a curse. I had meant to think over future lessons in the carriage, to remind myself what a boy of 10 might need to learn, but every time I tried to concentrate, I thought of Richard's face, and my mind balked. It was not my fault I was returning to work so soon. Everything else aside, I needed the money. I had spent the last 4 weeks in cramped lodgings, living off the sale of a necklace Richard had given me when we were first married. Even my mourning was reused. I had been forced to make the best of the black dresses I had worn when my mother died, darning here and there, turning out a seam, unplucking tighter threads at the waist. A bad start, perhaps, for a widow, but it was not as though I had ever been a good wife.
Hi, Katie. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Secrets of Hartwood Hall.
Hi, Chloe. It's very nice to be here.
So can you start us off, Katie, by introducing your novel to us and telling us what The Secrets of Hartwood Hall is all about?
Of course. So The Secrets of Hartwood Hall is a historical novel, a bit of a gothic historical novel. So it's set in the Victorian period in 1852, and it's about a governess who embarks on a new position at a big spooky country house, and everything kind of goes on from there.
And I noticed that in your acknowledgements you've said that Jane Eyre was like this huge inspiration for you, and you've kind of wanted your novels to be almost in conversation with each other. So is that where the novel began life with the genre first, or was it kind of from another place?
Yeah, probably I think from sort of the genre, and sort of not just from Gothic literature, but sort of from Victorian literature as a whole. I'm a massive fan of Victorian literature and have been sort of since I was a young teenager. I first read Jane Eyre and I was about 13 and I have always loved it. And so I wanted to write a book which was kind of in conversation with Victorian literature and was sort of a bit of a love letter to all the Victorian novels that I love, but also kind of dissecting certain things about them or looking at them in a different way. And especially, yeah, Jane Eyre and The Tenant of Arthur Hall, I feel like were sort of big influences on The Secrets of Howard Hall. And I had a lot of fun kind of playing with Bronte tropes and sort of tropes and themes from Victorian Gothic literature and sort of Victorian sensation fiction too, which was just a lot of fun, I suppose.
Yeah, but I also feel that maybe you hinted at there, that your novel is quite contemporary as well in certain things that you touch upon and certain themes that you bring into it, which I felt kind of gave it that edge. You don't feel like you are reading a book that was written in like the 1800s. You do feel like you're reading a modern book with all the kind of things that people love about Gothic literature embedded into it.
Yeah, I mean, I always think I love reading historical fiction set in the Victorian period, but I also love Victorian literature and I read a lot of Victorian literature. So for me, if I'm reading a work of historical fiction set in the Victorian period, it has to be doing something that a book actually from the Victorian period couldn't do. Otherwise, why would I read that instead of a book actually from the Victorian period? So it's the same when I'm writing, it's really fun to write a book set in the Victorian period and to play with Victorian themes and ideas and to write a book that, you know, is firmly set in a world and is authentically Victorian in the way that people sort of could have behaved, but also that has a different feel to it, because I wouldn't want to write a book that could have just been written in the Victorian period. Or I suppose maybe I would like to write a book that could have been written in the Victorian period, but would never have been allowed to be published in the Victorian period, I suppose. Yeah. Maybe it would be a better way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that idea. You're kind of being subversive in a way. You've been publishing for years and you have some lovely childhood stories about your kind of love of writing and stories and storytelling. And I know that your kind of love for that began when you were a small child. So I'm wondering, and I guess I'm interested to know whether this is your first attempt at a novel, or have you got a drawer or a folder full of started novels that you
have? So many folders. So many folders, yeah. Yeah, so it's definitely not the first novel that I have written. I counted and it is the 13th novel that I have finished.
Some, but not for you.
Yeah, exactly. And that is counting some of the books I wrote as a teenager, which are sort of very bad and I would never return to. But I've written a lot of other books. I've been trying to get published for quite a long time. So I had I signed with an agent sort of must be sort of 7 years ago first. And I had a few books out of submission with sort of no success and so on. So yeah, Heartwood Hall has definitely not been my first attempt. Just my first one that sort of made it through, I suppose. Yeah. And I've sort of moved around in genre. I was writing kind of different genres for a while before I sort of realized that historical fiction was where I wanted to be, which I don't know why I didn't realize earlier, because I love the Victorians and find them fascinating. And I really enjoy writing things set in the Victorian period. So it sort of feels like although it has taken me a while and there are lots of forgotten books in folders on my computer, I feel like Heartwood Hall was a good one to be the first one to get out into the world, I suppose.
Absolutely. I can feel your passion for that kind of genre just through your writing and the way you speak about it. But I'm interested to know, 7 years you've been with your agent and obviously you faced a lot of rejections and feeling like you're on the edge of being published and then having it almost pulled away from you. What has that been like as an experience then? How did you kind of keep going and coming up with new ideas when thought then you've written another book that then might not be published? How was that as an experience?
Yeah, it's been a bit up and down and strange. And it's been a bit of a bumpy road because I had one agent for quite a few years who then left the industry sort of just after I'd finished writing Heartwood Hall. So I ended up then looking for a new agent, which obviously worked out fine, but felt a bit disruptive, I suppose. And I had a few books out on submission that didn't get picked up, which is disappointing. I think I sort of, because I have been writing for a long time and wrote several books before I got an agent, then wrote several books before I got a book deal. So I've always just been like, well, it'll be the next book then. It'll be the next book. And I think working in publishing myself as an editor has been both like helpful and disheartening because of that. Because on the one hand, I've worked as a fiction editor for lots of years. And so especially in one job I had, I was working at a publisher where we were taking on a lot of new debut authors. And that was quite a weird experience, sort of helping other people achieve my dream, but also I was very excited. Their books are fantastic and I had a great fun working on the books, but that was quite odd. But it also meant that working in publishing, I did know that like so much of it is not, if your book does not get published, it doesn't mean your book wasn't any good. It means it wasn't right for a list or for an editor or for a publisher. It means it wasn't right for the market at that time. It means that a publisher was looking for something else or the publisher had something similar on their list already. Like I, as an editor, have read books on submission that are great but don't get published. And I know that that happens. So I think that was quite useful for always making me think, well, it's not that I am not ever going to be published. It's just the wrong book. I'll write the next book. I'll write the next book. I'll write the next book. I'll see what works. Because I did, you know, I love writing and I really enjoy it. So I didn't want to stop, but I did believe that I could write some things that were good. So if it was the wrong book, then it was the wrong book and I would write another one. Which is not to say it wasn't disheartening at certain points, but I did, yeah, I guess you just write another book and try again and hope that that works in the end.
What do you think it was that was special about this book then? I mean, you said there's an element of right place, right time and right book, right time, but do you think there was something that made this book stand apart from the others that you'd written?
So I wrote The Secrets of Heart Tall very like purposefully to be publishable, which, you know, I think is not very artistic maybe, but I think is fine. And especially because I've been trying to get published for years, that was something that I was thinking about a lot. And actually, so when I first started working in publishing, I worked in nonfiction. And when I was first out on submission with a couple of books, that was when I was working in nonfiction publishing. Then I moved to working into fiction publishing. And The Secrets of Heart Tall was the first book I started writing like very soon after I started working in fiction publishing, back in sort of 2018, 2019. And I think that actually I had a lot of knowledge of the market that I was getting, that I was sort of newly getting working in fiction, that really, really helped me think, okay, what makes a book marketable? What is a hook? Because I remember my first agent always used to say to me, Katie, this is a really fun book, but where's the hook? And I would be like, but what is a hook? I don't know. You can tell me, but I don't understand. And then I started working in fiction publishing and I was like, oh, that's what a hook is. And I still can't articulate it. I don't think anyone can, which is the problem. It's so hard. But I feel like a lot of the stuff I used to write didn't fit into a clear box, or I wouldn't have known, you know, how would you market it? That kind of thing. Whereas with The Secrets of Heart Tall, when I started planning it and thinking about it, I wanted to write a book where I knew what box it would fit in. If I were an editor in a publishing house, I would know how to market it. I would know how to publish it. I would know what cover to give it. I would know what the comps would be. And thinking that way really, really helped me write a book which I thought could be sort of commercially viable and publishable. But then I say all that, but actually I had massive fun writing it, and it kind of reflects all my interests, and I love the Victorian period so much, and I had so much fun exploring the Victorian period through it. So I guess it was a mixture of, in a way, maybe it was the book I wanted to write. And actually some of the ideas I had been working on before then were sort of actually much older ideas. Sort of the books I had out on submission in my sort of, yeah, a few years ago, I'd actually sort of started working on them many, many years before that. So actually Heartwood Hall was a really, really new, completely new idea that maybe reflected me more as I was starting to write it. But also I was kind of thinking a lot more about publishing and marketing and so on, which I don't think works for every author, but I think because I have been trying to get published for a while and I kept feeling like it's not the right book, I felt like if I tried to think more in terms of an editor, with my editor brain on, I suppose, more than with my author brain on, my writer brain on, then that sort of helped me create Heart with Tall, I suppose.
It's so interesting, isn't it, because I'm sure there'll be people that are like, they just couldn't do that at all. And for them, it's more of a, you know, just a creative, artistic endeavor. Mm. And then there is an element that, being realistic about it, there is a certain point where your book moves from being yours and a piece of art to being a product. And you do have to start thinking of, what are my comp titles? Because, of course, if you want to go and get an agent or book deal, then you've got to start thinking, like you said, about how is this going to be marketed, where's it going to sit in the bookshop, but what are the titles are kind of speaking to each other around my book. And I think it's fine to be that person that goes, well, I don't want to consider that, you know, that's not what I'm about. But also I think it does no harm to think about those things, and certainly when I've been writing my second book, I have been thinking, what would my comp titles be? And what, you know, like you said, what's the hook going to be? What's the kind of wider conversation of this book? And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to think about that, because your editor is going to be thinking about that. And the acquisitions, that those are going to be the topics that are discussed. So I don't think it's a bad idea for the author to be certainly aware of it, whether it kind of, if obviously if it impinges upon people's writing, then maybe try and shut it out for a while.
I think it depends on the author a lot. And for me, I find it quite helpful for sort of like pinning down what's a book, what a book is about. Because sort of as an editor, I spend a lot of time like writing back cover copy. So now before I start writing a new novel, I like write myself some back cover copy because actually that's quite helpful for me to think, okay, so what is it about? What's the thing that I would sell it on? And actually that makes, that's useful for sort of commerciality, but it's also useful for writing it, because then I know sort of what's at the heart of the book, I suppose, or what I want to be the main thing about it, I guess.
Yeah, and I've heard that advice a lot, like write the synopsis first and then go from there. And I think it is quite useful in pinning down that kind of the bigger question that your book is trying to deal with, which I always find so difficult. But anyway, that's the whole world issue. Let's touch back on The Secrets of Heartwood Hall, because I'll talk to you more about your kind of your journey and your process later, but I want to hear a bit more about the book first. So as we've mentioned, this novel deals with so many kind of favorite gothic tropes of yours and this brilliant atmosphere that you've created to make a kind of slightly ghostly, mysterious place. How did you combine this kind of atmosphere that is familiar to us in these kinds of novels alongside these familiar tropes, but also make it kind of fresh and contemporary? How did you decide to kind of blend the two together?
I don't know. I feel like a lot of the fun of writing something in an established genre like gothic that has a lot of tropes is that you can play with them. And especially because gothic tropes, like some of them are a bit silly. Like actually it's really fun to mess around with those kind of tropes, and it is really fun to try and turn them on their heads or do something different with them and write in response to them. And especially sort of in sort of Victorian tropes, because I read a lot of Victorian literature and I really love it and I'm very sort of immersed in it. So that means it's kind of, it's quite easy in my head to subvert it or to think about subverting it. And Victorian literature itself is like always subversive. All of the Victorian novelists are all subverting each other all the time. And it's quite fun to sort of, for me, it's quite fun to sort of think about what different things I could do with a particular trope or what different things I could do within the space of a genre like gothic. And gothic is quite fun because it is, it can be a little bit silly, but it can also be a bit spooky. So it's quite a good sort of vehicle for telling a story if you have a mystery, if you have something that feels a bit spooky going on, then I think that gives you a lot to work with, I suppose.
I can imagine the mystery element really helps, and certainly I was kind of romping through your novel being like, I need to know what's going on. I have to find out. Tell us about the newcomer to the story then, Margaret. She's your main character. She comes to the house wanting to kind of know what's going on, but also carrying her own secrets as well. So how did you go about creating Margaret? And I wondered whether she changed a lot as you kind of edited your book and developed the story, or whether she kind of had quite, you had quite a strong sense of who she was from the start.
I feel like I had quite a strong sense of who Margaret was from the start, less so the other characters. A lot of them changed a lot in the edits. Susan especially was like a completely different person in the first draft. But Margaret, I think, was a bit more stable. I think probably what did change a lot in the edits was sort of at what point, at what stage in the book you get to know things about Margaret, at what stage of the book you get to know things about her past and sort of her own secrets. But I feel like she was always relatively stable as who she was. I think especially if you write a book in first person, once you're going to get into the voice of a character, it's a bit harder for them to change, or they sort of become a bit more of a stable force in the book, I suppose. And I really enjoyed writing her. I found her a really interesting character to write. And I wanted to write about, because I find Victorian history and sort of the position of women in the Victorian period so interesting, I wanted to write about Margaret, who is this 29-year-old woman. She is a governess, but she's also a widow. She's been married for 3 years and her husband has died and she's gone back to work as a governess. So she has this sort of unusual position within Victorian society because she's a governess, which already means she's sort of a little bit outside of the class hierarchy. She's not upper class, but she's not a servant. She's in this house, but she doesn't really belong with sort of either the family or the servants. And then also she is a widow, which was a sort of uneasy social position within the Victorian period, because within the Victorian period, sort of the the ideal for women was supposed to be marriage. You know, you were supposed to get married and have children. That was what you were supposed to do, especially as a middle-class woman, which Margaret is. That was meant to be the priority and focus of your life. So effectively, you were a wife, or you were waiting to be a wife. So someone who had been married and whose husband had died sat in a sort of uneasy social position, and the Victorians were uncomfortable with widows, who were often more financially and socially independent than women who hadn't been married, were sexually experienced, but not in a relationship, like not in a marriage, which the Victorians didn't really like. So Margaret comes to this house, but she's a sort of outsider to the house, but also she sort of exists a little bit outside the structure of Victorian society, which I had a lot of fun writing about. And a lot of her sort of character arc is about her coming to terms with her marriage, which was not very happy, and sort of reflecting on the last few years of her life and how she's changed, which I just, found really interesting to write about, I suppose.
Mm. So one of the things that Margaret keeps herself busy with, shall we say, is the gardener Paul. And they had some very sexy liaisons. And I'm going to out myself now as a big fan of Paul, mainly because I was picturing Paul Mescal. Can you tell us why you had this kind of subplot for Margaret? Obviously, you've got the main mystery element, but what did this relationship give to Margaret in the novel?
I think there's a few things. I think some of the themes that are kind of quite important in the novel are things to do with sort of class and gender and power. And I feel like Paul and Margaret's relationship helps me look at those themes and explore those themes, because they have a sort of complicated power dynamic between them. And Margaret is a few years older than him. She is also middle class. He is working class. She is sort of officially above him in the house, but he's also been at Hartwood Hall a lot longer than her. He knows, like, he's much more familiar with the house. He knows everyone much better. And, you know, within the Victorian society that he is in, being a man does kind of change their sort of position towards each other. So I wanted to kind of use their relationship to look at those themes. But I also wanted to use their relationship to look at sort of the way that Margaret gets over her marriage and tries and learns new things about relationships and about herself through Paul. And I found him a really interesting character to write as well. And actually, he probably changed more over the writing of the book than Margaret did. I spent quite a lot of time like trying to get his character right. And I like wrote a long short story like from his perspective to try and like get in his head more and make sure I knew sort of what he was thinking and feeling throughout the novel, which I found sort of very useful to do. So I guess there's quite a few different like things that sort of subplot serves, I guess.
When it comes to the mystery side, and I guess this is more of a plotting question, how do you decide how you kind of place the secrets and the uncovering of them? Because I guess you know, it's not just like there's just one mystery in the house. How did you kind of decide where they're all going to fit in? And did you know all the kind of mysteries when you started, or were there some that kind of came to you later on as you were writing?
So I had like the twist and everything and the mysteries all in my head from the beginning, from when I started writing, and I sort of knew what was going on. But then I changed a few things as I went along, and there was sort of one thing about how the twist kind of worked, or like how the ending worked, that I changed like fairly late on down the line, like after I had signed with my new agent, but before the book had gone out on submission, I suddenly changed something like relatively dramatic about the ending. But I did kind of have all the twists and turns and mysteries in my head from the beginning. But definitely in the editorial process, in editing sort of on my own with my agents, with the editors as well, like where things were revealed and what happens when moved around a lot, like the whole like middle section of the book just like changed order all the time, which I definitely, I find pacing and plotting quite tricky. That's probably the thing I find sort of hardest in writing a book. So I feel like, when things were revealed probably did move around a lot and probably took a lot of like trial and error, I guess.
Yeah, I noticed I think it might have been in your acknowledgements that you, or an interview that you gave, that you were a big fan of the Plot Stormers course by Writers HQ, which I also love. I think their site is amazing. They have some brilliant.
Yeah, it's really good.
So I took from that you're a big planner, but maybe it's because you find the kind of planning side of it difficult that you lean towards trying to plan it out. Am I right on the right track there?
So I like planning, and I always have a plan before I begin, but usually then What I tend to do more than being a planner, I am like an editor at heart. So I write a first draft quite quickly, and then I change the order of everything and tear it apart. And then I do that about 10 times, and then maybe I'll be happy with the book. That's how it usually goes. So I wanted for Heartwood Hall, because as I said earlier, I wanted to really consciously think about like making it a commercially viable book. And the two books I'd had on submission previously, the kind of feedback I got had been, we love your writing, it's very quiet. There's not enough plot, there's not enough happening, which was kind of true. So I thought when I started writing Heartwood Hall, I thought, okay, I'll look for something like the Plotstormers course, which I then did to help me sort of pace and plot the book. And so I did the Plotstormers course, which was really, really helpful. The plot is in the end quite different from the initial plot that I plotted out with Plotstormers. But the first draft, I did use the plot I created through Writers HQ Plotstormers, which was really, really helpful and definitely like made a big difference to making sure there were events of significance happening, even if I then kind of changed the order a bit on the editorial process. And actually, I feel like Plotstormers and that kind of Plotstormers was very good for like the main plot, and then actually subplots, sort of some of them came on my second or third draft. But yeah, in general, I find like once I've got a first draft, I feel much happier, even if I'm going to completely change every word. Once I have something to work with, I feel like I know what I'm doing much more.
So you don't mind then having to write that kind of horrible first draft where you know it's a complete mess, because your favourite part is going back and editing it and polishing it and making it better. Yeah,
I like that. I'm trying now to write more slowly and think about it more, because I feel like actually when I was previously, as I said, writing lots of novels to see which worked, then it made sense to write a very quick first draft. And sometimes after the first draft, I'd be like, no, I'll just leave this one. And sometimes I would rewrite it. And so now that I'm like, oh, well, actually, you know, I have a book that I need to write for a deadline. So I'm trying to be a bit more sort of, trying less to do the messy first draft thing and more to think things through on the first draft more. But I feel like that isn't as natural to me. I feel I still want to sort of write a very quick first draft and sort it out afterwards, but we'll see.
So what was it like for you then as an editor to work with other editors on your book? I mean, I know you're used to working kind of in collaboration with different people in your day job, but what was it like when it was your book that was being edited?
Mostly fine, like mostly really good. The feedback was really helpful. I think also because actually as a writer, you do have so many like things that you can't see about your own work, which you just can't see in your own work because it's yours. So having an editor help you with that and see the things that you can't see is very, very helpful, especially because as an author, there's so much stuff you know that's in your head that you understand. You know why a character's doing something, or you know what they don't know. And especially in a book like The Secrets of Heartwood Hall, where there are lots of secrets, if you know all the secrets, it's really hard to know what the reader is and isn't getting on the page. So actually having editors is just very, very, very valuable. And I mean, yeah, I feel like I just agreed with pretty much everything that I was given. And I think in general, most editors are like, my sort of policy as an editor and as a writer is that if an editor says there is a problem, there's probably a problem. The solution they give you might not be the only solution though. So if you don't like the solution, there'll be another solution. But if they say there's a problem, there probably is a problem. So that's sort of my policy as a writer, I suppose. And it's something I think about a lot as an editor too. You know, if there is something that's really bugging you as an editor, then it probably isn't working, but there might be 17 different ways that you could fix that. And the author has to see what is the right way to fix it for them to keep it still being the book they want it to be in the book it is. I really enjoyed working with editors. And it is nice being edited from the other side, because I really love working as an editor as well. But I to a certain extent, I can apply my editor brain to my own work, but there are certain things which I just can't see, which I do need more eyes for.
I often think that I can see it and I know what the problem is, but I need someone to go, this is a problem, before
yeah,
I can go,
yeah.
Oh yeah, I've tried to hide it, I've put some sellotape on it and hope for the best, but yeah, it hasn't worked. And often I think, when you're being edited, you know what the problem is, or you know there's a problem with something, but you just sort of hope you've kind of bodged it enough that they're not going to notice. But editors are amazing, and they notice every kind of bit where you've tried to just smooth things over and think, that'll do, that'll be fine, and it's not fine.
That's true.
So you also have a BookTube channel called Books and Things, which I will link in the show notes because I think there's some great videos on there, particularly if you're interested in the kind of publishing journey from signing the contract to being published that you filmed along alongside what was happening in your life. And you also obviously talk about the books that you love as well. Do you think having that kind of platform already has helped you have more confidence in speaking about your book and your writing and your work? And do you kind of buy into this idea that it's been helpful for you because you have kind of like a existing audience or following already? Because I know that's something that authors, particularly when they're starting out, really worry about, you know, should I have TikTok? Should I have Twitter? Should I have whatever? What has that been like for you? Has it made a difference, or you don't think it has?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I think it has made a bit of a difference. I think, but not a massive one. I think in general for authors who worry about, for aspiring authors who worry about social media presence and that kind of thing, it's never going to be, unless you have like 17 million followers, it's never going to be the be all and end all. It's always just going to be a nice bonus. If you have a nice following somewhere, that's a nice bonus, but it's never going to be the issue. Like it's always just an added bonus. It's never actually something that really makes a bigger difference. And to be honest, I think social media can make a bit of a difference in book sales, but it's not that big a difference. There are a lot of other things going on that make books sell, and it can't all be done just on your following somewhere or anything like that. I think actually the way that BookTube has probably been the most useful for me is that, like working as an editor, it's given me a really like big familiarity with the market. And I've been doing my BookTube channel for sort of 8 years. I love it, and I read a lot of books, and I read more books because of it, probably. It's very hard to tell because I've been doing it for so long now, but I read a lot, I review a lot of books on it, I watch a lot of other BookTubers who talk about books. So my familiarity with sort of the market and other books out there has definitely been increased by BookTube. And I also think if you, in the say again, a bit like work as an editor, if you review books, then you do think about what worked in a book for you, and thinking about the books I read and why I did or didn't like them and what worked for me and what didn't, like all of that stuff actually does help with writing. So there's probably been a lot of things that BookTube have helped me with sort of like beneath the surface, I suppose. And it probably has increased my confidence. It has increased my confidence like in general, but again, I've been doing it for such a long time. I started doing it when I was quite young, so I find it quite hard to tell what is general growing up and what is BookTube helping me with my confidence. It probably does help me. You know, I think podcasts and that kind of thing don't feel that unfamiliar to me. Although I talk very quickly and I usually digitally slow myself down on BookTube, which I can't do when I'm if I go to a literary festival or if I'm on a podcast. So it's a few things like that where I have to remember that I'm not always making my own video. But yeah, I think BookTube probably has helped beneath the surface. But in terms of actual like following and that kind of thing, there are some people who watch my BookTube channel who have read my book because of that. But, you know, it doesn't make that big a difference in the end of the day. I think it's felt like there is a really supportive community around me, especially from other BookTubers, but also from people who watch my channel who have been really excited about the book. That has made a really big difference, like emotionally, and that's been really, really nice to have. And lots of people on BookTube have been reading the book. And when I had my book launch, quite a few other BookTubers sort of came along and supported me, which was really, really nice. So I feel like it's been a really lovely added bonus, but like aspiring authors shouldn't worry about their social media presence. I just don't think that is, it's always an added bonus, but that's not like what publishers are really looking for. It's all about the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure because you've worked as an editor for so long and you've got this amazing insight into, you know, what goes into a book and what's important and what's not. I was wondering if you have any kind of practical or emotional advice for anyone who is about to sign a contract or about to be published. What do you think? What do you think it's important they understand about the process of being published that maybe isn't made so obvious when you're kind of new to it all?
I think one thing maybe is that, like, I feel like especially if you're an author and it's been taking you a while to get published and you finally get a book deal, it feels like the end, like milestone achieved, mission complete. Like you're working for a really long time and you have a book deal and it's fantastic and it's the best thing ever. And it is, but also it's not the end. It is the beginning of like a career which is going to be up and down and difficult. And it's very, very competitive to get a book published. But once your book is published, that is also very competitive to get sales, to get another book deal, all of that stuff. So I think maybe the thing that is useful but scary to know is that like it's just the beginning of the next stage, which I think is something I have thought about a lot and that I'm finding kind of useful to think about, because I think especially because I was trying to get published for such a long time, when I got my book deal I was like, well, that's, you know, done. Which I don't think I really thought, and I've worked in publishing enough that I know that that isn't how the publishing industry works, and I know there are a lot of hurdles and that things are difficult and that the market is very competitive and affected by, you know, lots of things. You know, the pandemic had a massive effect on the market, and cost of living crisis and all of this stuff affects books and how books work. You cannot just magically sell a ton of books. But I think maybe it's important to kind of like go into having a book deal with a healthy dose of like, let's see how this goes. This is the beginning of another exciting thing, but it's not necessarily like the end of the road. Yeah. Is that helpful? Maybe that's just a bit dispiriting. I don't know. And also I think to remember that it is also a job, because I think it's such a hard balance. Because, you know, for a lot of us who have been writing for a long time and who love writing, and if it goes from being your hobby to being something that you are paid for, whether that is a small section of your income or a larger section of your income, and whether you're still doing a day job or whatever else you're doing, it's to go from this is my hobby to I have a commitment and it's now professional, and the people I'm working with are professionals and it's their job and it's my dream, but it's their job. That is quite a sort of strange relationship, which is something I've always found working as an editor. I'm freelance now, but when I was in house and working with authors, it is very strange when you're all the team working on this project together, but for some of you it is your day job and for one of you it is your life's passion. So I think approaching a book deal as a new job is maybe, which is a bit scary but also very exciting, is maybe a good way to kind of think about it. I don't know.
Was there anything that was surprising for you? Because I know you know it inside out, but was there anything that took you by surprise or maybe you weren't expecting in the whole kind of publishing experience? Maybe not so much the kind of the post-publication part, but was there anything for you that was unusual or challenging during that kind of moment from when you signed your contract to when it was published?
I mean, I think a lot of it is, on the one hand, I've worked as an editor a lot and I sort of know the process, but also every publisher is really different. So even just simple things like I have spent a lot of my life briefing copy editors and I work now as a freelance copy editor. And when my book was being copy edited, the copy editor was in touch with me directly. And I've never worked at a publisher where the copy editor is in touch with authors directly. The copy editor has always gone like through the editor. So even just that kind of small thing where I was like, oh, this isn't how I thought the process was, which was fine and worked really well. But like, it's even just things like that where every publisher works differently. And my book's been published in the US as well. And I know, you know, US publishing is a bit different and I don't really know much about the US market. I don't understand that in the way that I do the UK market. So that was different. So actually, in a way, I thought there wouldn't be any surprises, and sort of everything has been quite surprising. And it's very different doing it from the author side in comparison to being in-house. And it's weird sort of the level of information you do and don't have when you're used to, as an editor, being in all the meetings and like, you know, being able to just like look up your sales figures on a spreadsheet or whatever. When you're like in-house as an editor working on a book, there's certain bits of information that you have, which as an author you don't have on your own book, which is a bit strange, but kind of makes sense. So yeah, so I suppose in some ways it has been more surprising than I thought. Yeah.
You found that kind of loss of control, I guess, difficult or not, because you didn't mind not knowing things?
Yeah, I don't think most of the time I mind. It's just a bit different, I suppose, and just kind of getting into a different mindset and remembering sometimes that I'm the author, not just like another person in the team working on this book that we're publishing together. like adjusting to a new role in the team, I suppose.
Do you think there was a pressure on you, because you work in the industry, to have a certain success or sell a certain number of books? Do you feel like, because you're already in that industry and you kind of know a lot of people that work in books, that you felt a pressure to be at a certain level, or did you not feel that?
Not like from anyone except from maybe myself.
Mm.
The fact that I'm like, if a former colleague of mine wanted to look up my sales figures on Nielsen, they could. That's a slightly odd thought. But like most of the time that doesn't, you know, I imagine anyone would actually bother. So yeah, not really like a, I suppose having worked in the industry, I probably have a clearer sense of like what figures I would have been happy with as an editor, which is not the same thing. And it's very different for every author, and genres and authors and, you know, strategies and everything is very, very, it just varies massively between books, which I know myself. But I guess, yeah, there's a certain amount of like extra knowledge I have, which is disconcerting. But sometimes it's useful. So I don't know.
I guess it helps. There are a lot of editors who become authors or people who work in publishing that basically, because everyone loves books and they love writing, that gravitate towards those jobs and then end up having a career as a writer on the side, or becomes their full-time job. So it's not like you're the only one that has to kind of go through that anxiety of going to be, I don't know, judging you for what you've sold or anything like that.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of editors turned authors. I think partly because the skills you need to edit a book and to write a book, it's like a big Venn diagram. There's a lot of crossover there. And if you love books, then, you know, I like working as an editor because I love books, and I like writing books because I love books. And, you know, it all kind of comes together, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So on the subject of books, finally, Katie, can you give us a little tease about what you're writing next?
I'm working on a second book now, which is also set in the Victorian periods, which is my favourite time period, but it's very, very different from Howard Hall. So very different in tone, nothing gothic about it. And where Hartwood Hall was a sort of claustrophobic story about very few people, the new novel has lots of different characters, lots of different perspectives, very different feel to it. So I think that's all I'm going to say, but I'm really enjoying writing it, and it's been really fun to write something that is very different in style to Hartwood Hall. It feels very different, which is really nice, I think, for me. And it's actually a much older idea and project. So that's like these characters for my second book have been living in my head for a lot longer than the characters in Hartwood Hall, which is kind of nice as well, I guess.
Mm. And a fun challenge, I imagine, to kind of write multiple perspectives when your first book was first person and fit in all these different characters as well. But it sounds really interesting, Katie, and I'm excited to read it when it comes out. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you. It's been great. Thanks for having me.
That was Katie Lumsden talking about her historical novel, The Secrets of Hartwood Hall, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.